Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Renee's Heart to Heart. This is Renee, and I'm glad you came by today. Today is Bullies to Buddies Day. And if this is perhaps the first time you've ever listened to the show, once a week we work from a workbook that was put together by Israel Kalman. He is the gentleman who organized and founded Bullies to Buddies. And his whole concept is about the golden rule. It's all about treating others the way you would like to be treated. So I think the whole premise of everything that we've taught over the past year in regard to bullying or mistreating others is about a little bit of inner strength. It's about knowing that if somebody is harassing you, picking on you, finding fault in you, I don't care whether you're 10 or 40. I don't care whether you're in elementary school, middle school, high school, college, or in the workplace. It's all about taking to heart what people say to you. And also considering the fact of whether or not you believe it. So yesterday we talked a little bit about this, Shelley and I, in regard to what if something's true that they're saying? What if something is in point of fact, obvious and true, such as a deformity of some kind or severe acne, which we talked about last week as well, and you're getting picked on for those reasons. That's harder to deal with because you can't say, I don't care what you say, that's not true. Or if somebody says to you, you're stupid or you don't know anything or you this or you that, you can understand that those things aren't true, that you're not stupid, and that you do get what's going on. And taking comments like that to heart can be harmful, so you need to realize that it's not true. And the only time it could be true is if you accept it. So standing on your own two feet, which is something that we were all told when we were young, doesn't mean putting your fists up. Doesn't mean bantering back and forth with slams. There used to be a word for that. There was a show. All of a sudden, it just came to my mind. Your wife is so ugly. You have to tie a bone around her neck to make the dog play with her. Things like that. Y'all remember things that there was a time when the worst insult you could throw at somebody was considered funny. And there were comedians through my whole life who made fun of their spouses or anybody. Don Rickles, who was somebody that as a young woman I disliked intensely because I thought he was hurting everybody's feelings. And he would say mean and nasty things about people all the time. And I remember thinking to myself, why does everybody think that's funny? Isn't he hurting so-and-so's feelings? And then, of course, as I grew and understood what they called a roast and things like that, it was all done in good-natured fun. And it was a good lesson for me because when something is obviously not true about somebody, well, like Don Rickles would roast fellow actors, comedians, show business people. And he would say derogatory comments about somebody like Milton Berle. Milton Berle was like an icon in the entertainment industry, an icon. And yet Don Rickles would make fun of him and he'd laugh. And understanding that is a big thing in your own personal life and coming to grips with the fact that the only time something really hurts you is if you let it in the wrong way. So that's what we talked about a lot the last couple of weeks, accepting and not giving any kind of credence to some of the things people can say to us and do to us. But the other thing in the workbook that we really are going to discuss today is about how we've been brought up, and this is true of all of us, even somebody as old as myself, about slipping into that infamous victim role and giving the people that are on you or picking on you or ridiculing you or being mean to you, you're just handing them more and more power. It's like, you know, you're giving them the opportunity to really let all the things sink in, because you fall into this victim mode, I'm going to go eat worms. Can't do that. You have to have inner strength, and that's kind of what Izzy teaches you, and you have to learn how to not stand on your own 2 feet with your fist clenched, but stand on your own 2 feet to not give credence to these people that are badgering you. I'm going to bring Shelley in. She and I have some good conversations about this because we grew up very differently. And some of Shelley's challenges I never went through, and vice versa. So it makes it interesting to see each one of our points of view when it comes to how we handled different things and how some things stuck with us, some things didn't. So even when you don't think something is hurting you in the moment, if it comes back to you and you remember it and there's a vivid recall, like a total recall of something somebody said to you, it did hurt you, and you have to get past it. So have I got you in, Shel? Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. I'm having a few computer issues this morning. I'm hoping that everything is all right. I see that Valerie has called in to listen. She likes to listen, or it might be Mike. I'm not sure. But I'm hoping that means everything is okay. My dashboard tells me everything is okay, but I had an awful time getting in, and I couldn't post anything to Facebook or Twitter this morning. So
well, when I first pulled in, I didn't hear anything. So I didn't know if it was my phone or not, so I hung up and I called back in. And then when I called back in, you were already talking. So, yeah, but it was only one time. It wasn't like I had been trying for a while. It was just my first attempt. So.
Okay. Well, everything looks normal on my dashboard. My timer is on and all that kind of stuff.
That's unusual for you and me.
I know. So the chapter that we're at right now is still talking about how we teach kids and how we teach other kids who are witnessing. That's the part of the lesson that we're into right now, instructing students to stop being passive bystanders and actively take the side of the victims against the bullies. And that's what everybody's taught, but In Izzy's way of looking at it, this intervention has become extremely popular, with many bullying experts declaring it to be the best way for a school to solve the problem of bullying. Some programs are based solely on enlisting the help of student bystanders. Now, the good intentions for that are bullies feel encouraged by other students watching and laughing when they pick on their victims. Therefore, we need to get students to stop being passive bystanders. That makes sense, because if you don't have an egg or honor, so to speak, then, you know, a little of the steam falls out of the perpetrator. Students are more aware of bullying than the staff is, so they are in a better position to intervene when bullying occurs. The bullies are more likely to stop bullying when their peers stand up against them than if the staff does. Having students stand up directly for the victims avoids putting them in the uncomfortable role of informers. And teaching kids to stand up for other kids builds their character. Now, those are all of the good intentions that are manifested by asking students to not just, you know, stand in a circle and laugh at the kid that's being picked on, or maybe even join in. Those are the reasons why they think that's a good idea. Now, the negative consequences are many kids don't want the responsibility of being security agents in lieu of the staff, and will insist this role despite adults, or will resist, sorry, this role despite the adults urging. As in reason number one, it gives kids the messages that they are helpless to deal with social difficulties on their own and that society must provide for someone to always be there to save them. I think that's a mistake, too. Although, personally, as a mom and a grandma, I feel strongly about, I tell my kids all the time, you know, you will always have me in your corner, right or wrong. For whatever reasons, you will always have me in your corner. And I think that's imperative to a young person's strength and their backup plan. I don't think that's a bad thing. There is no guarantee that bystanders will put a stop to any given bullying incident. Sometimes it can turn into a big fight. Just as kids are being enlisted to help the victims, the bullies may respond by enlisting their own friends to help them, causing the situation to escalate. In a case reported in New York City newspapers in 2009, a teenage boy was killed while standing up for a girl who was being insulted by a group of other boys.
Wow.
It can be intimidating to stand up for someone who is bigger and stronger and may have more friends. Many kids wouldn't want to be put in a situation where they can get hurt by getting involved, and their parents wouldn't want them to do that either or be in that situation. It requires students to be judges in bullying situations. Judge is a serious and delicate function that requires wisdom and experience. Amen. It is not always obvious who are the good guys and who are the bad guys in any given situation. In fact, many people learn to use their apparent weakness to their advantage by creating hostile situations and getting others to do the fighting for them. Now, you understand. Can you think of a scenario that would fit that comment, Shell?
Well, I just went through that with my niece's daughter, my great niece. Where she was brought into the principal's office as being the bully. Meanwhile, she was the one being bullied because she chose not to do anything about it. And the girls, plural, that were bullying her decided to go to the principal's office and say that she was bullying him. But this is one girl against a group of six. And you know, none of the authorities had that little light bulb go on. Well, how does one person bully a group of six girls, you know? And there were witnesses, that, you know, to the contrary. But they went in and they played the victim mode. She's a little bit taller than them. You know, she's very pretty. And for whatever reason, these girls just didn't like her. And they went in and they said that she was threatening them, that she was being, you know, threatening and things like that. And meanwhile, it was actually the reverse. And she shrugged them off. She wouldn't get into conflict with them. She would just laugh and walk away from them. And I think that incited them. It actually made them more angry that she didn't engage them. So they went to try and get her in because they knew her particular school. I guess they had an assembly about bullying, and they have like a zero tolerance about bullying. So these girls actually used that policy to try and get another student in trouble that was, in fact, not the bully.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about the kids, though, that just do things like that to get more attention? What about a situation where you have... you have a couple girls who see that they can get a lot of, I mean, kids do lots of different things to get attention, believe me. And sometimes even as an adult who's seen all kinds of behavior, it's shocking sometimes to see what people will do to get attention. We've even talked about battered wives who prefer any kind of attention they can get, even when it's bad attention. So what if we have a tween or a teen who is doing just that, who is putting themselves in harm's way and actually silently what's a good word, strategically inciting other people to pick on them. And then at face value, it looks like somebody else is being the aggressor, when really behind the scenes, the other child is the one that is, you know. There was a show one time, I can't remember all of it, it's just coming to my mind as I'm saying these things, that someplace where the kids, there was one girl who was actually playing everybody and making it look like everybody was being mean to her when she was actually going around and like ferreting little bits of information to different groups of people until people started ganging up on her. So what if you have a situation like that and you're depending on untrained professionals such as other students to make a call on something like that? You can't do that.
I mean, I even see that kind of stuff in the workplace. I think
me too.
I think it's the exception to the rule, though. But yeah, I have seen that behavior. I've seen people in the workplace that are just constantly going to management over this particular staff member or that particular staff member, and they seem to be constantly being victimized. They seem to be, I mean, from their perception and from what they're saying. So now, if there's somebody who has any sort of ability or talents, HR will almost try to look out for them and kind of admonish the staff. Look, you know, leave this person alone, you know, blah, 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 whatever. And they kind of get annoyed. You know, they treat the person with kid gloves like they're fragile. If the person's not very talented or brings a lot to the workplace, they just get fired because after a while, HR can't handle the constant, come and save me mode. But so I've seen it play out. We've seen it play out two different ways. But it's almost like a propensity where they need that type of supportive intervention, and they will actually create scenarios to make it look like they need it. They have like this desire to have people fending for them. And I'm sure it comes
from
some level
of getting the attention, period. You know, just having that extra attention, period. So we both understand that can happen. So imagine leaving the the outcome of a scenario like that up to a bunch of other 15-year-olds. How is a group of 15-year-olds even going to imagine something like that? Although sometimes I think they're brighter than we are. Don't get me wrong. I have great respect for young people because they see things a lot of times that the rest of us don't see. But to leave that kind of a decision or a analogy up to a bunch of young people, even when a lot of times adults don't see it, I think is a big mistake, and you're actually making the problem bigger, I think. So I guess the outcome of this discussion, this thing that Izzy has put out here for us in the workbook, is that it isn't a really good idea. And I'm not sure what the best idea is when it comes to the other kids involved, the onlookers, the spectators, what is expected of them. I mean, you can go to any. Have you ever been in a country bar years ago where they did all the line dances and the bars were huge? And I once witnessed a fight where everybody was still dancing and just watching. Somebody beat the hell out of somebody else, and nobody intervened.
Wow.
Why? Because a lot of times, especially between couples, you know, the wife or the best friend or something will turn on you. So people notoriously stay out of real personal situations like that.
Don't like responding to domestic abuse, because here they come in, the husband's beating the heck out of the wife right in front of them. They go over to arrest the husband, and the wife's jumping on their back or hitting the police officer, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's the exception to the rule, but it's happened where police officers have actually been injured by the victim, because now all of a sudden they go into protection mode over the individual that was just, you know, beating the heck out of them. So, you know, most victims are going to feel rescued when they see the police, but it doesn't always happen. And when you have mutual combat, when you just have two people that got drunk and are acting badly and they're attacking each other, there really is no victim. It's just literally mutual combat. You know, but, you know, you can't tell that walking into a situation sometimes, whether or not you have an attacker and a victim, or if you have just two people acting badly. And that's where the discernment comes in. And even police officers sometimes don't judge the situation accurately when they first walk in. That's why they don't like going into domestic abuse. You know, if there's a true victim, they want to get in there and they want to protect the victim. But sometimes it's just literally mutual combat.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he even at the end of the paragraph that I just read is, this is very common within the family when the situation can be played a little bit. When weaker or younger children learn that they can cry and get their parents to take the side against their bigger and older siblings, children discover that the tactic works in school when others are willing to stand up for them. And, of course, that's exactly what I'm talking about. And once they learn that, to get that additional supportive attention, they actually manifest a problem so somebody can come in and save them.
Right. Because they get used to that, or they like that cycle of attention. Right, I see what you're saying. See, like when I was younger, my sister and I had a great relationship growing up. We have a great relationship now. We had a little bit of a stumble there for some years where we had stopped talking to each other, but then we eventually got back on track and now we're as close as ever. But for most of our lives, we were best friends, and we are again now. But what had happened was, when we were younger, even though we loved each other very much, she could be a bit of a bully. She would hit, you know. She would kick me in the shins when she got pissed off. She would either kick me or scratch me or something like that. She was a typical like cat fighter, and it used to really upset me because I would never touch her, and I wasn't necessarily afraid of her, but I didn't know how to make her stop. And I used to go to my mom. My dad wasn't home, so I'd always go to my mom and I would tell her, you know, make her stop. Well, this went on for years, and my mom never would. She said, if you can't figure out how to make your own sister not pick on you, she said, then how are you going to be able to make strangers pick on you? And that always annoyed me that my mom wouldn't step in and help. But it took me a few years, and finally one day I stood up to my sister, and I made her stop. And what I did is I defended myself one time, and it shocked her, and she never touched me again after that. And like I said, I was never afraid of her. I wasn't a bully, so I didn't like being physical. But one time I defended myself, and she saw that I was going to, and just never messed with me that way again. And then we just had a different relationship. But my mom got such a kick out of it, because then my sister ran to her saying that I hurt her, and my mom said, well, I think it's about time. She said, now maybe you'll leave her alone. And that was it, and that ended it for my sister and I. We never had those types of physical quarrels anymore. And this is when we were teenagers. I'm not talking about as adults. But
right.
Kind of that cycle. And it was also not relentless. You know, like she would get physical with me, and then months would go by, and then she'd get physical with me again just because she'd be in a bad mood or I had something that she wanted or that kind of thing. So, you know, it wasn't like I lived in fear of her. But growing up, she was a little bit bigger than me because there was a year between us. And then at one point, we became the same size. And when we became the same size, I was really able to stand up to her better. You know, but I'll never forget that all those years, my mom never stepped in, you know. And all she kept saying to me, she said, you have to figure out how to deal with this, because if you can't do it with your own sister, you're not going to be able to do it with perfect strangers. You know, and she also knew that she wasn't, like, injuring me. I mean, she never put me in the hospital. It was more, you know, it was more of a, you know, I don't want to say annoyance because it was a little bit more than that, but it was never physically harmed. My mom obviously would have stepped in if she had ever truly injured me, but, you know, that type. She was just hurting me but not injuring me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that kind of sibling rivalry happens in every family, even boys versus girls. Absolutely. Versus boys and girls versus girls. So I think sibling rivalry is a part of growing up, and I think it is your first, as a child, it is your first real interaction with dealing with somebody picking on you is with one of your siblings.
But and, sometimes, like you said, and what Izzy says, what if my mom had interceded? I wonder if that would have affected our closeness, and if I would not have developed a little bit more personal strength about myself, and if my sister would have become angrier. You know what I'm saying? Because my mom didn't get involved, it never escalated. It kind of stayed where it was until I figured out how to handle it, and then we both moved on from it. But this is what I'm saying. I agree with Izzy that it was probably a good thing my mom didn't intervene, because it didn't grow into something else. I didn't develop a need to have somebody step in and help me, although I might have gone there if my mom had responded. But if my sister had gotten in trouble, who's to say she wouldn't have become angry with me, and maybe it would have ruined our relationship. But it never did, because it was just like you said, it was just like normal sibling rivalry.
Well, I think it can happen like that. I think a real hatred, very sadly, can evolve from a parent giving more attention to one sibling over the other because the other one has some poor behavior, because you don't analyze when you're a kid. You just wonder why mom's always on her side. I didn't really do anything that terrible. Mom's always taken her side in everything, and you simply are not old enough to analyze what's going on. So it just is a matter of who got the most attention. And who
right.
appears to be the one that's babied. So you're right. I think I think it can change who you are as an adult. Certainly hamper your abilities to learn how to get along with others. Because if you've always got somebody standing there who's going to say, oh, don't do that to my little girl, she doesn't like that, you're not ever going to have any friends. I guarantee it. So it
True.
Is about... You know, I think I shared my mother's and father's way of Barbara and I. Barbara and I were very close in age, and then it was a few years before Joey was born. Joey was born in 55, and I was born in 48, and Barbara was born in 49. So there was 5 and 6 years between us and him. So there was no rivalry there. He was our baby brother. So what it did do for us is it increased a little bit of our fighting, our inability to always get along. A lot of times Joey would be our our reason for fighting. One of us would want to do something with him, for him, to him, whatever, and we wouldn't want to share him. You know what I mean? So we would have that end of things as well. But my parents' answer was, if it got so bad so that we were bickering and fighting all the time, the first thing my dad did was set up a boxing ring, and he'd pretend he rang a bell, and we could go after each other. And, of course, the first time we hurt each other, we didn't really want to hurt each other, you know, so it would stop. And then as we got older, if Barbara told on me, I got a nickel. If I told on her, she got a nickel. So the rivalry, we didn't want that. We didn't want the other one to get something that the other one wasn't getting. So consequently, they even stopped the tattling by doing
that's
it like that.
Sorry, by the way.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny because it really worked. It really, really worked. And it was so simple because Mom just got sick and tired of she'd be sitting there. I can even see her in my mind's eye sitting there holding Joey, feeding him or doing something with him. And I'd be like, Mom, we called Barbara Bobby when we were little. Bobby's doing this, Bobby's doing that. And Mom would say, come here, Bobby. Barbara would walk in the room, and she'd think she was going to catch on. Mom would hand her a nickel. And boy, that pissed me off.
That's hilarious. I love it.
But
I love it.
You know, so we stopped doing that. So so I do think there's a lot of validity in what Izzy is saying about leaving things up to kids. But I also believe I have always taught my kids to don't just stand by and see somebody else being hurt. That doesn't mean I want you to step in the middle of it. I want you to find somebody or do something so that somebody else can bring it to a stop. I think in a lot of the schools today we have walking monitors. I don't know what they actually call them, but they're people, sometimes volunteers, sometimes other parents that walk around in the lunchroom or to walk around in the halls and just keep an eye on everything that's going on, walk in and out of the bathrooms and make sure everything is cool. Whenever I go over here to Royal Palm Beach High, there is always, they all have different titles now. When I was a kid, the one who took care of the kids that got in trouble was called the dean. You had a boys' dean and a girls' dean. And she was in charge of any kind of reprimands or suspensions or any kind of punishment for a kid who behaved badly in school. Now I think they call them assistant principals and things like that, and they walk around the school during the break between classes, and they're always watching. I think a lot of times if a kid thinks somebody's watching, nothing happens. You don't have to break it up because there's people around that are paying attention. And that's productive in my eyes. That's, you know, even in a workplace, Shel, you've heard me say this a lot of times, everybody needs to know that they're being watched. Even the best employee, the best person in the whole world can be different. They think nobody's looking. And that's just the simple truth. It sounds kind of mean, and it sounds kind of, like I'm saying that we're all evil. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that it tends to make us all better if we know somebody's paying attention to what's going on. So I think that's one of the most important things, having faces of people that you know are in charge, even in a workplace. In big factories, remember the day that we talked about big factories and the work in big factories? We talked about it from a health point of view. But while we were talking, I made notes about the fact that in big factories like that, people used to get paid more. I don't know whether it still works like this, but you got a wage, and then you got, if you went over, like say your job was to finish 300 parts in a day. If you did 400 parts in a day, you made extra money. So it was called piecework. And if you went over your set quota for your regular wage, you made more money. So this made people a lot more productive and a lot less time to start any kind of trouble. If you had a slacker who just did the 300 because they didn't care if they made any more money, and there are people like that, who just sat around or walked over to other people's station while they were trying to make the extra money and started stuff, there were always floor walkers that walked through. There's factories in Ithaca that have, like, I don't know, I don't remember how many floors they have, but they're big buildings and long. And these people would just walk up and down and just keep an eye on everybody for that reason. So in a school, I think it works exactly the same way. If you have a kid that is an overachiever and knows that if they do an extra paper, they bring up their grade in their class. If they do this, they get a better grade. Then you have the kids that don't care about that kind of stuff, and they're the kids that somebody has to keep a little bit of an eye on. It doesn't mean to say that they're a bad child. It just means that they don't have that overachiever attitude, just like those workers in the plant. So having somebody
a lot of that can be stimulated by how the parents or other authority figures react to the student that's either achieving or underachieving. Like I had said yesterday, my sister and I were brought up the same as far as my mom was concerned, but my father treated my sister very differently than me, and it always bothered me growing up because he always compared her to me. I had an easy time in school. I was always like an honor student. I always had, high scores, A's, when we had numbers, I would always be in the high 90s in all my classes. One year I had 105 in chemistry because not only did I have 100 average, but I was working in the lab and I was making 5 bonus points. It was supposed to bring your score up, but I had 100 scores, so I ended up having 105 for 2 quarters, this type of stuff. Well, my father loved this because his father was a genius. My grandfather was an actual genius. He was a nuclear physicist, believe it or not. So my father, I guess he saw a bit of his heritage in me because of how easy science and math were. But my sister had gifts that were not scientific, that were not scholastic in that regard. And I saw my sister strength at a very young age. I saw that there were things my sister liked to do that she was really, really good at that I hated. I just didn't like that stuff. But my father never complimented my sister for the things she was good at. He always said, why can't you be like your sister? Why can't you be like your sister? And what it did is it tore my sister's self-esteem down, made her very insecure, and made her feel stupid. And my father would actually call her stupid. This was one of the reasons why at a very young age I started losing respect for my father. And it used to make me angry. And it did set my sister up to be a different adult than me, where I'm very self-assured because I got recognition from my father, I got recognition from school teachers, and here my father would browbeat my sister, tell her she was stupid, that she wasn't up to par with me, which just irked the heck out of me, and then she'd go to school, and she would be an underachiever because she had this, like, well, why bother? I'm not going to be able to do it anyway. I was the one who always told her how smart she was and tried to help her through school. But it didn't come from, but she was getting mixed messages. And the more my father browbeat her, the worse she got in school. So you can actually see here the difference. Now, if my father hadn't been that responsive to me, who's to say I would have done that well in school? But I liked the attention. I liked the recognition. And I went for it. My sister never got the recognition, so she went the other direction. And it's interesting that you can actually see it with two kids growing up in the same household, with the same maternal influence, but the completely diversely opposite paternal influence, from my father, and how we both ended up going differently with our aspirations.
Well, that's for sure. I do think, but of course, you see so many things that parents do wrong and what they say about hindsight. So there is a lot of that, and there is a lot of problems with how different parents treat siblings and who gets this kind of attention. The attention that we get can either be positive or negative, and like I said before, when a kid gets no attention, just like when a spouse in some cases gets no attention, any kind of attention fills the void. And I think that's why we get so many people who do things that they shouldn't do because, just going through every day and never getting any attention drives you to that. Look at all the movies that we've seen where wives go out and cheat on their husbands, not because they really want to cheat on their husbands, because they want his attention. Or kids that do, you know, that do something in school, steal or take something from somebody else. Why? Not really because they want this or because that's, you know, that's their purpose behind taking it. It's because they want it. It's because they want some attention. And I know that there are some people that don't thrive on attention. There are some people who are really loners. My sister Barbara, she would have been all right if she could sit in the sun, read a book, and not have anybody bother her all day long. I'm not like that. I have to have interactions. It's what makes me thrive. So possibly I was one of those kind of kids. I don't remember anything imperfect about myself, of course, ha, ha, ha. But I do think that because I appreciated and thrived on attention, then I'm sure that I did things that I probably shouldn't have done, picking on Barbara or whatever. I honestly don't remember because I think we put those out of our heads when we do things that we know we shouldn't, but I like attention. I like interaction. I like talking to people. I like being with people. I turn on every TV in the house when I'm here by myself because I don't like all that quiet. Whereas
right.
my sister loved it. You know, she could, and Big Spike, my husband, I married somebody like that. He
mm-hmm.
likes solitude. He likes sitting in a room with nobody else and just sitting and reading a book. He can do that in the middle of the night. He'll get up and go sit someplace and read a book for 3 hours and then come back to bed.
Right. Right.
You know, we're all different in regard to that. But needing the attention often, especially a very young child, makes them be, you know, do anything for any kind of attention. But in the bullying regard, I think the attention that they're trying to get is not from teachers, not from their parents. It's trying to be king of the hill in a school. And, I mean, that goes back to as far as any of us can remember, I'm sure, believing that if everybody thinks we're a tough guy or a tough girl, then we have more friends. And in most of the time, it's true. You do. So...
Does Izzy, anywhere in Izzy's book, okay, let me formulate this question differently, because I started it like three different ways. Does Izzy cover anywhere in his workbook the different types of bullies? Because obviously we know there's more than one type. There's one that just wants, to, like you said, to have power and have following, you know, so they're going to be a bully. They want kids, you know, they want to feel that power over another human being. You have other bullies that have very traumatic home lives, violent, and they're coming to school and they're just needing to vent, and so they take it out on somebody that's vulnerable to them because they're probably vulnerable to somebody else, you know. So there's different types of bullies. There's different motivations for bullies. Does he actually go through the different types? Because each type of bully would respond to a different type of approach, I would think.
Well, and you're exactly right. And he does, he has a chapter. We are only on, in Izzy's workbook, we are only on page 24.
Wow. How many pages?
139.
Wow.
And... more than that, I didn't even turn the pages, 141. But he does get into the psychology of people and kids. God, I'm sorry about all the coughing today. I've got a doozy of a cold, all this funky weather, and it's my lowest time of March. Coughing up a storm here. I think that the psychology of people he gets into in like the fourth of the book, And he talks about sibling rivalry, and he talks about teaching kids to have resilience. And he even gives kids sayings, you know, like, if you think I look like a nerd, you should see my dad. If you think I'm fat, you should see my mother. If you think I'm ugly, you should see my sister. If you think I'm stupid, you should see my brother. I mean, he gives all those kind of things to kids, to just, like, a lot of what he teaches has to do with humor as well. And
right.
The lightning ability of laughter, I think everybody understands. And he calls laughter the best medicine. He talks about being able to laugh at yourself as well as others, not to be hurt if somebody laughs at you. I mean, you know that old saying, I'm not laughing at you, I'm laughing with you.
Mm-hmm.
We all laugh at each other all the time. I mean, this family, my family, we are notorious for laughing at each other if we do something stupid or if we fall down. Somebody sent me a video, a man sitting in his car in a very wintry state. He's there to pick up his daughter from school. And he looks up, and where he's parked, there's this little corner of the sidewalk. And here comes all the kids out of school. Every kid that walks down this corner of the sidewalk falls down on their butt. It's icy as hell, right? Well, he is laughing his butt off in the car, videoing all of these kids falling down on the corner. And I'm thinking to myself, what a sicko. You know, only a dad would that, right? But it is funny. Nobody gets hurt. But he's got these kids. Some of them come running around the corner. He says, uh-oh, this is going to be a wipeout. This is going to be a wipeout. And some of these very footed kids just slide with it, you know, and wouldn't fall. But then you see some of these kids who fall right on their butt. And, again, nobody gets hurt. His daughter comes out, and she gets past it because she runs through the snow because she sees all these people falling down. She gets in the car with her dad, and he says, you've got to watch this. So then she sits there and laughs with them while they watch all these people fall around the corner and fall on their butts. Well, I think most of us are like that. I think most of us, if we saw somebody not be able to get up, I had the feeling this was a warm, friendly man. He would have run right over and helped a kid that got hurt.
Of course.
But why didn't he go over and say, you know, kids, don't walk here. You're going to fall down. He didn't do that. It was too amusing for him. Watch all those kids fall down. And I
right.
got to tell you, I watched the 10-minute video and laughed my butt off. So, you know, and I do think laughter puts us all on a common ground. All of your actors and entertainers out there, the ones that are always the most loved are what?
Are the ones that make us laugh.
Right, the comedians, they're always the most loved. And sometimes they're the darkest one in real life.
Right, because that's their source of humor comes from. It's almost like a survival mode to get through things that have hurt them.
I think he has a Freudian saying in the book that we're not anywhere close to, so we'll read it again at some point in time. The first human being who hurled an insult instead of a stone was the founder of civilization. That's attributed to Freud.
I like that.
The man that we just lost recently, Sid Caesar, who was an icon in show business industry as a comedian.
Oh, yes.
Laugh at yourself, and you will find yourself laughing at things that would make other people cry.
Wow. Yeah. No, I like that. I like that. And the ability to laugh at yourself, first of all, it's very healthy. You know, to laugh with someone is different than to laugh at someone. And when you can find humor with yourself and you can help people to lighten up when they look at themselves, life just becomes more rewarding. It becomes a little bit easier because when you don't make everything such a big deal, I mean, I know people, that, you know, I've gone through a decent amount of challenges in my life. So have you. And yet I have a really good attitude towards life. I have a passion for life. If, you know, if somebody were to ask me what kind of life I have, I would say very, very interesting, very eventful, really wonderful. I've known wonderful people. I've had wonderful experiences. Yet if I were to sit there and tell you some of the things that happened to me, which I have, people look at me and they go, oh, my God, you went through that? And they're always so shocked that I have such a happy attitude about my life because I've had some pretty serious stuff happen to me. And you and I've talked, and I know you've had some serious stuff happen to you. But I know people who literally have had very little happen to them in the way of what I would consider challenges or what people would classify as bad or traumatic, and yet they have this, like, devastated attitude about their own life because they take everything so exaggerated, everything so seriously. They can't seem to lighten anything, and they don't seem to have the ability to kind of be observant and look around them and see what other people have gone through and survived and actually became stronger through. They get stuck in their own head into their experiences, which a lot of times are not really that awful, but they make them bigger than they are, maybe, like you said, to elicit attention because maybe they think people will feel sorry for them and they'll get attention or whatever. But what they end up doing is they end up making themselves weaker as they get older. By not being able to have a humor about what's happened to them. And they end up really squelching any joy they would get out of life by not having a little bit more humor about stuff.
Exactly. If you know, and I'll tell you something. You never learn to appreciate the really wonderful things in life if you don't have a few bad things. I don't really know that there's anybody that has ever lived a full life without some tragedy, without some loss, without some sadness, without some challenges. I don't know that there's anybody like that. There's certainly nobody I know like that. But going, let's look at life like a teeter-totter. There's ups and downs, pure and simple.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know the strength of being at the bottom of a teeter-totter is fulfilling, and the exhilaration of being at the top of the teeter-totter is exciting. So that's really what life is all about, the ups and the downs, which teach you to appreciate. When you have an up, you appreciate the down when you're down, and vice versa. And without those things, and, of course, you can't say that to a child because it means nothing. It only means something when they get to that point in their lives. I got a call from my youngest brother this week, and his daughter has been going steady with a boy. She's a tween, and he broke up with her. And my brother said, she had her heart broken, Rini. And I said, is the kid dead, and laughed. And he goes, not yet. And I said, the worst part about it is we liked him too. And I
Aww.
Said, well, you can only hope that he will become a friend instead of something more significant. Because when something like that happens when you're young, you have to hope that those people will always be your friends. But it is about knowing the difference and having relationships and judging who really cared about you and who really didn't care about you. All of those things are a part of life. And, of course, bullies, too. The man or the girl or the kid or whoever was mean to you, if you paid any attention at all, taught you something about yourself. So sometimes we have to take those things and analyze them for what they're worth, because they're what build our whole structure. They're what make us who we become. Without the trials and tribulations you've had, Shelley, would you have dedicated so much of your time to animals and health and all those things? No, you wouldn't have.
Right.
I mean, you'd have been in a different direction and probably done something just as worthwhile. But your life, as it has unfolded, is what brought you to where you are now.
Right.
Just like mine.
Right. And the whole thing is that I can look back on where my life was, and it has, I have changed direction several times in my life where I was going in a pretty steady path in one direction. Something happened that at the time seemed to be something that other people would classify as bad, you know, and I just look at it as a challenge, and I responded to it instead of reacted to it. And I responded to it and kind of went with this new direction I was shoved in. And it always turned out, which I didn't see at the time that I switched gears or that I made the turn, but maybe 6 months or a year or sometimes 2 years down the road, all of a sudden I was like, oh, this is why I was shoved in this direction, because then I developed a new passion or I developed a new direction that was very motivating to me. So sometimes... time to realize why a shift happened in my life, but then it made sense. So where I am today is the culmination of probably about a dozen heart ride turns, you know, where all of a sudden I was going straight and then I had to make a 90-degree turn in one direction because of life's, you know, different things that happened to me in life. And it's kind of fun to look back and see that, like, all these crazy turns I had to make actually makes sense now, you know. And if people could be a little bit more trusting that their life is opening up in a way that will make sense at some point and not get so devastated when change happens, they're going to find out that that life can be a lot more rewarding. See, I didn't fight it. Sometimes I was upset by some of the changes that happened, but I have this faith in God or what, you know, whatever you want to call it, and that there was always a reason that something was happening, and whether I liked it or not, I kind of stayed faithful that at some point it was going to all make sense, and it always did, but sometimes it took years for it to make sense.
Well, and I think that that's a big lesson for all of us, to understand that a lot of times things do happen for a reason, and even though it doesn't give you much comfort in the moment, You do have to know that there's much bigger forces than any of us at work, and things do happen for a reason. And the old sayings like when one door closes, another door opens, have meaning, and they are true. And sometimes we're not supposed to be doing something that we think we're supposed to be doing, and something will happen to change that. So believing that and understanding that is good for you. It's good for you because then you don't always feel like a downtrodden, oh my God, who's going to slap me next kind of a person. That's not really what's happening to you.
Right.
What's happening is you're living your life. We're out of time. I will continue with the workbook, of course, next Tuesday, but I want to remind everybody that... we're going to have the mental health is still on my page. Please check the dates and see if anything is appropriate for you to be a part of. But the big one is April 25th at the Embassy Suites over here on Belvedere. So, but I also want to thank everybody for all the well wishes to my daughter-in-law and my son for the loss of my daughter-in-law's mom. This week, the well wish in full force, and it is so appreciated. Thank you all. And I want to send everybody out there to have a great day today. The sun is shining here in South Florida. It's supposed to be a beautiful day, and I'm still sorry for all you snowbound people up north, but spring will be here. It will be here. It can't help but get here eventually. So have a great day, everybody. God bless, and we will be back tomorrow. Tomorrow is the health show, and we're going to talk about something very interesting again in regard to your health and your well-being. So God bless, everybody. Have a great day. Thanks, Shell. You want to say goodbye to everybody? You got time.
Sure. Yes, thanks, Renee. And goodbye, everyone. Have a wonderful day, and we'll speak to you in the morning.
Bye-bye.